WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
But the question now is, what's in the news in early 1990? What happened in the 1980s? Well, in 1982, Disney bought the United Kingdom and turned it into a theme park, renaming it the United Magic Kingdom. Also in 1982, New Mexico instituted the first solar electric chair. And during the 1980s, a very successful new magazine was published. The magazine was called Fred, the monthly magazine for people called Fred, featuring articles like Fred Forum, The Joy of Fred, and Fred Like Me. Well, this is some of what I've learned about the 1980s from a new book called The 1980s, A Look Back at the Tumultuous Decade, 1980 to 1989. With me is one of the authors and editors of this book, Christopher Cerf, whose name you may also recognize from his work with the National Lampoon and not the New York Times. He's also worked for many years with Sesame Street. Now, after Christopher tells us what he saw in the 1980s, we're going to open up the phone lines, and we'll talk about what you're looking forward to or dreading about the 1980s, or if you're a visionary, you can give us a call and tell us what happened in the 1980s. So we'll be opening up the phones in just a few minutes. Chris, welcome to Fresh Air.
Well, thank you. It's fun to be here.
The first thing I'd like to know is, what were you doing in the 1980s?
Well, I spent most of the decade gathering material for my forthcoming book on the 90s, actually.
Good one. Tell us about putting this book together, The Look at the 80s.
Well, the project actually began after we finished doing our New York Times parody last fall, which is called Not the New York Times, and came out during the strike, the newspaper strike in the city. And a fellow named Peter Elbling, who was my co-editor with Tony Hendra on this project, called Tony and me up and said, you know, I've heard that a lot of people are writing histories of the 70s, but I'll bet if we really hurry, that just maybe we could write the first history of the 80s. And I think we did. I haven't seen too many other histories of the 80s done yet.
We should talk a little bit about what has happened in the 80s, since you are one of the few historians of that decade.
Well, actually, there were many historians who worked with us on this project. We had something like 50 people altogether. But you're right, there aren't too many others, though.
What happened with food in the 1980s? Everyone had to continue eating as they do now.
Well, actually, by the end of the decade, there wasn't much food, but I'm getting ahead of myself. And in the early 80s, probably the biggest development was the at-home McDonald's franchise. With the gas shortages of the period from 80 to 83, it was very hard for people to get out to McDonald's. So McDonald's started franchising individual homes, and if you applied for a franchise and were accepted, they would send you a few patties and a little uniform to wear in your kitchen, and even a ladies' room and men's room signs for your bathroom at home, and a little tiny golden arch you could put outside your house. And the slogan, of course, I'm sure you remember, Terry, was, you do it all for you. Later on in the decade, of course, there were tremendous food shortages caused by a whole lot of things. One of them was caused by something that wiped out most of the continental European food supply all at once, an event which has come to be known as the cooking of provincial France, when a solar satellite, a solar power satellite, which beamed its electricity down to Earth by means of microwaves, actually went astray, and the beam cooked an awful lot of the southern French coast, and that eliminated a lot of food. Strip farming, of course, was very bad for the food supply, too. So by the late 80s, there really wasn't much to eat. But I think in the 90s, that should get better.
Well, I understand that broccoli became an endangered vegetable.
Yes, an endangered vegetable as a result of strip farming, specifically.
Is it true that there was petroleum-based food that was being prepared?
Well, yes, of course. That's really the hope for the future. Actually, petrofood or raw vegetables are called crudité number 6, actually. And we have a picture of those in the book. That was introduced by United Multinationals in early 1989 in an attempt to get around the food shortage. And it really has worked very well. It tastes pretty good, except for the fact that it's gooey and black. It looks like normal food. But cooking it has not worked out too well. It tends to explode when you cook it.
Chris, can you remember for us what was predicted when you were growing up, what was predicted for the future, what you were taught to look forward to?
Well, what I actually have always loved predictions of the future and kept a lot of magazine Sunday supplement kind of articles around that said, this is what the 60s will be like, you know, that were written in the 40s, that kind of stuff. And they're always totally wrong. Everyone had personal helicopters, for example. There were monorails connecting cities. I'm sure you remember all those things as a kid, too. Or there'd be gigantic television screens on
They have it now.
Yeah, but they used to have them on the walls of buildings, you know, that you'd see pictures of. This is before TV was even invented. Someone sent me something from the 30s about what the 50s would be like. They always assume everything's going to go 10 times faster than it does, too. Everyone's going to have those little stole aircraft, you know, with the wings that fold back and they go straight up in the air. I haven't seen too many of those yet.
I remember all the 1984 visions, and I always figured if there was going to be a Big Brother, that Big Brother would be broadcasting out of little megaphones on streets and stuff. Looking back on it now, it seems really funny that I had such a really primitive technology for Big Brother to be using.
Yeah, though actually, the book by Orwell was the basis of the big musical hit of the 80s. Michael Kerb, who back in 79 was Lieutenant Governor of California, became governor when Jerry Brown quit to become president of CBS. And then he himself put his governorship in a blind trust and went off to make the musical movie version of 1984, which starred Marlon Brando in a cameo role as Big Brother. The difference between it and the novel, by the way, is that it had a happy ending, as you probably remember, because almost everyone has seen that movie by now. And at the end, when Winston is in room 101, O'Brien comes up to him and says, hey, you know, there's someone here who really wants to meet you, and he likes some of your ideas. And it turns out to be Big Brother, played by Brando. And there's a big musical song at the end called There's Going to Be Some Changes Made Around Here, which the Bee Gees wrote, by the way. And Twyla Tharp choreographed the Dancing Rats. It's a beautiful movie, really.
Well, I think that some of my favorite music from the 1980s was one of the shows that you write about in the 1980s. I agree with you that it was really terrific. It was a show on Vietnam that had a wonderful score to it, Cockeyed Optimist.
It was based on the book Tales of South Vietnam and was called South Vietnam, but Cockeyed Optimist was in it. This Nearly Was Mine, which General Westmoreland sings. Suddenly my mind is blank. Dites moi pourquoi, of course.
Me Lai May
Call You, that's right.
One of my favorites was I'm Going to Wash the Hair Right Out of That Man.
Yes, that was a defoliation number. Of course, Vietnamese shows were very big in the mid-80s, Vietnamese nostalgia shows. There was a show called Vietnamania also.
What was in that?
Well, that was an attempt, very much like Beatlemania during the 70s, to re-evoke a period. And they did that by putting punji steaks in the aisles of the theater. And they actually strafed the audience at various points during the production.
Well, that really does evoke a lot of nostalgia, doesn't it?
Yes, it was. I mean, have you seen the show? It's really
No, I didn't get to see it. I found in the 1980s, although things were traveling at twice their speed, I had less time, what with all the fast food franchising I was doing in my own home.
You worked on that?
Yeah.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Listen, we're going to open up the phone lines. If you have any recollections of the 1980s you'd like to share with us.
Or any questions.
That's right, because Christopher would certainly be happy to tell you everything that happened. We're at 387-6660. Our area code is 215. My guest is Christopher Cerf, one of the editors and authors of The 80s, A Look Back. And this is a nostalgic look at the tumultuous decade of 1980 to 1989. So if you'd like to give us a call and reminisce about the 1980s, or if you'd like to give us a call and tell us what you think's going to be up in the 1980s, what you're really dreading or looking forward to, why don't you give us a call? Our phone lines are open. We're at 387-6660. And as Chris said, he'd also be very happy to respond to any of your questions about the 1980s. Was Marshall McLuhan right? Did our new forms of media make print obsolete?
Well, print is pretty obsolete here in 1990. In fact, some people have told us that our book may be the very last one that's ever published, which to me is very sad. But there were only 7 books published in 1989, so the trend is not good. There were some fine books published during the 80s, and of course some fine magazines. You mentioned Half Life, which was a re-embodiment of Life magazine for the nuclear family. And you know that the New York Times and Variety merged in 1985. McLuhan was right about the new media becoming dominant, certainly as a political force, too. And New York Variety Times, which would have such headlines as Afghan-Paki War held over for sixth big week, has become a fixture. I'm sure you must read it every day, too. That's still around. Among the big books of the 80s was one book called The Ludlum Formula by Robert Ludlum's publisher, explaining how he wrote all those thrillers back in the 70s. And then there was a book called Dead by Pierce Paul Reed, which was the story of a group of airline passengers who failed to survive a crash in the Andes. You recall he was the author of Alive back during the 70s. A book called The Kennedy Teeth was very big, which was written by the orthodontist to three generations of Kennedys. A really interesting straight-from-the-mouth report.
Well, there was also a magazine called Fred Magazine.
Oh, yes. Well, of course, Philadelphia is the center of the Fred movement. The Fredding of America is the book by Fred Friedrich that started all that. And the Fred Convention of 1988 was held right here in the city of Brotherly Fred, as they chose to call it. And they published their own magazine, Fred. And you mentioned the article, Fred Like Me. It's really become quite a militant movement and a cult.
Do you think that the Fred movement is going to be a force into the 1990s?
Well, I think it will. Though I think the Lloyd Bridges movement probably is more important. You're familiar with the cult of worship of Lloyd Bridges. It's a Trinitarian movement where they worship the Father, the Son, and the other Son. And they've been buying up a lot of Episcopalian churches and deepening the baptismal fonts.
Interesting. You learn a lot.
Yes, you do, you know. It's a fascinating period, the 80s, really.
We're going to go to the phones and find out just how fascinating the 1980s was. Our number is 387-6660, and there is an open line if you'd like to give us a call. My guest is Christopher Cerf, one of the co-authors, co-editors of The 80s, a look back at the tumultuous decade 1980 to 1989. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes, good afternoon. I guess the thing that that surprised me looking back on the 80s was that it would have to be under the heading of One More Time, I guess, is that... following Carter's re-election, as you remember, and
no, I don't remember.
and further aimlessness, that the country turned to Richard Nixon again and elected him. It was an astounding thing, which of course took the Supreme Court to decide whether or not it was legal. But I think that was the thing that shocked me most about the 1980s.
Well, actually, your history's almost right. In 1980, Carter did become president again in 81, but it was not because he was reelected. He became Kennedy's running mate, actually, in 1980. When Kennedy won the nomination, Carter very generously, and to hold the party together, very selflessly, accepted the vice presidential spot on that ticket.
Was assassinated.
No, but Kennedy did make a fatal mistake, or almost fatal mistake, which was, in order to win white middle-class support during the campaign,
right,
he appointed Alan Backe to be his personal physician. And then, unfortunately, not very long into his term as president, about 10 days to be exact, he was forced to resign for health reasons,
right,
and Carter became president again.
Right.
But you are right about Carter becoming president again. That you were right there. Now, Nixon became president, but not of the United States, but rather of the United States of China. He went to live, as you may recall, in China about 1981, I think, when the Chinese government appointed him its advisor on Vietnamese affairs.
I don't know how I could have forgotten it. Must have been.
I don't know. I mean, it's a long time ago.
I couldn't.
Well, this really makes me fret about what's happening to Americans, that they have such a really dim sense of history.
Well, it's part of the decline of print, I think.
Well, listen, I'm sure I saw my version on television, and I was following the election very carefully, and maybe it was the cable that I was watching, but I'm sure where I was, from where I was sitting, Nixon was elected.
Yeah, but it was probably Chinese television you were watching.
Well, with all the communication satellites, you never know what country you're picking up.
And of course,
that's
the
right.
Problem is once you've seen one Chinese show, half an hour later, right?
Well, that's absolutely right. You know about Chinese dinner theater, don't you? Which was a big movement during the 80s. Yes, that's very much like that. And you know, a lot of American waiters would work in the Chinese dinner theater until they could get jobs as real waiters.
Listen, it's really been nice talking to you, but I really recommend that tonight in your spare time you just read up a little more on your history books and get things a little more straight.
I'll try to do that. I will do that, Terry. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to ask Mr. Cerf, about a month ago when or a month or two ago when his book came out.
That was about 11 years ago, actually.
Yeah, oh, that's right, 11 years ago. Time Magazine said that you were thinking of putting together another humor magazine, and I was wondering if that was the truth.
It's true. We're not there yet, but I don't know if you're aware of a publication called Not the New York Times, which we mentioned a little while back. It came out in New York during the newspaper strike. And it's occurred to us it might be fun to do a parody paper on a regular basis. It wouldn't be a parody of the Times this time, but it would be a newspaper format. And we've been talking to people about financing that with some luck, I think. And we're hoping that maybe before 1990's out, if not 1980, that we might be able to start such a project. But it's not, it's more a dream than a reality so far, but we're working on it.
Well, the reason I ask is that I'm a cartoonist, and I'm tired of getting rejections from the same old people.
Oh, you can get rejections from new people.
If I could get some rejections from you, it would be...
Oh, sure. Well, send your cartoons right in.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. 387-666. That's a lot of sixes. 387-6660 is the phone number. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, one question for you. Who won the World Series in 1984?
The Cincinnati Reds did, actually. In 83, they had lost the series, probably. You remember that 1983 was the first all-year-round baseball season.
Uh-huh.
Bowie Kuhn had been pushing for that, and unfortunately he met his death during that series because he sat through the final game, which was on December 26th, in a blinding snowstorm wearing a Lacoste shirt, and he was found several hours after the game was over. But the Reds lost that series to the Yankees when they actually lost the ball in the top of the ninth inning in this blinding snowstorm, and the winning run scored against them. But they came back to win in 84.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Thanks for calling. Bye-bye. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yeah. I'd like to say that I'm dead serious now. Don't get me wrong. The communists are planning to brainwash the United States and take over the world in 1980. I don't know if it's 80, it could be 1981. They're doing this by means of the TV, and we can stop them.
How can we stop them?
By changing everything we've done so far. You follow me? Follow the drift?
Yeah, caught the drift.
And you got to change, or else you're going to take over the world by brainwashing.
Right. Well, the born-again communist movement was quite important, as you probably remember, Terry.
Oh, I remember that well.
Yes, which was...
We did a lot of phone-in shows with some born-again communists.
And they were quite right about the state withering away, as a matter of fact.
You know, there was talk of them, I heard, you might know if this is true or not, of them aligning with the Fred movement, with the National Fred movement.
Oh, you're kidding. I haven't heard about that.
Well, think of the power that they'd have.
Oh, my God.
It was very terrifying to me.
It certainly is.
Yeah.
It is, really. Also... Okay. We have to prepare for nuclear war because the communists are planning for nuclear war.
Yeah.
All their buildings that are made, they have nuclear fallout shelters. They're all made with nuclear fallout shelters, which the United States have not.
Yeah, well, they're very smart to have those because the National Rifle Association successfully lobbied during the 80s for people, the individual right of individuals to have A-bombs. And, of course, there were a great wave of bank robberies that were done with atomic bombs, as you remember, Terry, I'm sure, again.
Oh, well, I have an impeccable memory.
Guys would come into banks, you know, holding A-bombs and say, if you don't give us all your money, or give me all your money, I'm going to blow up this bank and all its branches. And it was a very successful technique for a while.
I'd like to thank our listener for calling. 387-666 is... Why can't I...
Having trouble with that.
Well, I found that in the 1980s, my memory... I took memory pills during the 1980s, but they didn't really do the trick.
Nostalgin, I believe that drug was called.
That's right. Yeah. You took it too?
Yeah, sure.
It had some bad side effects. I started to remember the womb experience, which was very unusual. But 387-6660 is our number if you'd like to reminisce with us about the 1980s, or if you have any questions. We have an historian of the 80s with us. He is Christopher Cerf, whose work you may also know from the National Lampoon and from Not the New York Times. His new historical work is called The 80s, A Look Back at the Tumultuous Decade, 1980 to 1989. And I hardly need to point out that this is a rare opportunity to talk with a historian of the 1980s. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air. Hi, go ahead.
Hi, is this me?
Yeah, that's you.
I just wanted to reminisce a bit about what went on with Halley's Comet.
With Halley's Comet?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it was first sighted in December of 1985, a little earlier than predicted. A lot of people thought it'd be January 86.
Right. It came ahead of time, and very unexpectedly, the astrophysicists didn't know what to make of it, but it exploded in supernova style, and instead of a spectacular show, we had a catastrophic meteor shower lasting several weeks.
Well, it was a spectacular show, too, though. You've got to admit that.
Knocked out most of the communication satellites, and people had to start sending messages by courier.
Yeah.
It really threw everything off balance.
Well, it actually was it presaged, just as it did in 1066, presaged the Battle of Hastings. It also presaged, of course, the Black Friday event, which was the beginning of the oil glut. When Chad announced its tremendous oil reserves and the oil price plummeted because everyone else had been hoarding their oil supplies, waiting for the moment, and they waited too long. And Halley's Comet was seen the night before that happened.
Well, no wonder.
Yeah. Always a kind of omen of doom, Halley's Comet is.
Right.
Listen, thanks for reminiscing with us.
Okay.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, I wanted to know about the conflicting reports that I heard in the early 1980s. There was a famous politician that had a sex change operation.
Yes, actually Abby Hoffman had a sex change operation, which you can read about in our book. In fact, he wrote about it himself, or she did.
Uh-huh. And what was the reason behind it mainly?
Well, I guess just why not? was the way he or she was thinking.
Okay, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for calling.
Right.
Did she go into hiding like he had done?
Well, actually not. She was a major part of the March on the Pentagon in 1987. You know, there was a pro-military march because as the volunteer army became more black, the white middle class cut off most of its funds. And being for the military budget became an extremely left-wing thing to be for. Joan Baez marched on the Pentagon holding a gun, you know, and Donna Summer sang at that rally, as you'll remember, "We Shall Overrun Someday." And Abby was certainly a big part of that march.
Okay, it's really good to find out about these things. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Hi,
go ahead.
I just was wondering, whose idea was it to have the presidential candidates fight it out in Madison Square Garden? Was that President Ali's or was it Vice President Steinem's idea? Do you know?
Well, you've got your facts just a little mixed up. You're very close. But Ali actually was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Yeah.
But he did stage a series of what were known as parliament-storming fights, where he had the idea that if he would have boxing matches against various heads of state, this would make him more influential in world politics. He tried that in New Jersey back in 79, boxing a round or two against Governor Byrne. And as the 80s went on, he fought against Begin. In fact, he wrote a lot of little poems about the people he was going to knock out, you know, keeping very much in the tradition that he was in when he was fighting real boxing matches. For example, one of his poems was, "In round number 5, President Sadat won't hardly be alive."
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Yeah, he also wrote, "Listen up, Mr. President Kosygin, by round 3, your head be leaking. As for that snooty Mrs. Thatcher, I'll deck her soon as I can catch her. And you watch, Mr. Premier Dung, I knock you upside your head till it rung." You remember all those.
Very good improvisation.
Yeah. Well, he wrote all those, and he also knocked them all out, except he won 16 of his 17 fights against world leaders.
The thing is, when he was deposed because he wanted to become world dictator, I mean, who suggested that Betty Ford take over the whole shebang? I forget who...
I think you did, actually, didn't you? Wasn't that your idea originally?
No, I wrote to her, but she never answered me.
But I think that's where she got the inspiration. She tends to credit you for that.
Well, I'll be darned. But maybe I had probably got my facts straight then.
No, well, I think you probably changed history and didn't even know it.
You know, that happens more often than you think.
Sure does.
Incidentally, I have a copy of your newspaper in New York. I understand it's bringing about $500 now as a collector's item. Is that right?
It's the first I've heard of it, but if it's true, that's fantastic.
Yeah, well, it's the first I've heard of it, too. I thought I just meant that.
Yeah, thank you. I'll give it to you cheap, $490. How's that?
You're a good boy.
No, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for reminiscing
thank
with us.
Righto.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Yeah, so I was wondering if Mr. Cerf could answer something. In 1980, I wonder if they answered the age-old question, why does the partridge bird lay his egg in the air?
No, they didn't, but perhaps you know the answer.
No, that's why I phoned in.
Hey, listen, Chris, you're the expert,
you know? Well, I mean, you know, historians don't have to know everything, Terry. I mean, that was 10 years ago now. I mean, if it was a 1989 question, maybe I could handle it.
Mm. That's true.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Sure.
Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hello. I don't know. I'd like to ask the guy there, does he remember right around, I think it was the fall of 83, when Mick Jagger was elected to the Congress, does he remember, was it he or his opponent who decided that the Canadians should get out of Texas when the U.S. decided they would have to intervene in that war between the Canada and Texas? Does he remember who decided that the U.S. should intervene? Because I remember in 83 that Mick Jagger was elected to Congress.
Yes, well, a lot of strange people were elected to Congress in 82, 83, actually. Became known as the Congress of Nuts. The reason for that was really could be traced back to, say, 1981, September 81, I think it was. The House of Representatives, as you may recall, back in the late 70s, early 80s, had gotten permission to televise their hearings, and the ratings were just awful. So Roone Arledge, vice president of ABC, suggested that maybe if they did the ethics hearings as a game show, that they'd get better ratings. And Congress was dying for any kind of exposure it could get, so they agreed. And the show Congressional Squares was born.
Who was the host of that?
The head of the House Ethics Committee, John Flint, Representative John Flint.
Right.
And it was...
You didn't have to dress in costume to
participant, No, you didn't have to dress in costume. What happened is they just would question each other, these congressmen, and trade more and more severe charges of wrongdoing in office. The ratings soared, but the public was frankly appalled. And as a result, the strictest ethics bill of all time was passed. And Senator Talmadge of Georgia, in announcing his retirement from the Senate shortly thereafter, said you'd have to be nuts to run for Congress after this bill was passed. And in fact, only nuts did run for Congress in 82 and 83, which is why we got strange bills like the one the caller is referring to there. And among other things they did was... they tried to get Norway made a state. They prohibited the use of meat and authorized Surgeon General Backe to spray cattle farms with paraquat,
right,
which also contributed to the food shortage we were talking about earlier, incidentally. And they also made it illegal for any householder to own more than 1,000 feet of twine.
That's true. I remember that when it happened, right?
Yeah.
Okay, you really helped me a lot on this history report.
Well, I hope so, yeah. You know, if you want to write that up or anything, you don't have to give me credit. That's fine.
Well, I'll have to because you really filled in the gap between the 81 and 83. So.
Well, I'm glad I could help you out.
Okay, appreciate it.
But thanks a lot for calling.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. If you'd like to get through, we're at 387-6660. If you're just joining us, my guest is Christopher Cerf, and you may know his name and his work from the National Lampoon, also from Not the New York Times. He's also done a lot of work with Sesame Street, and his latest effort, along with Peter Elbling and Tony Hendra, is a book called The 80s, A Look Back at the Tumultuous Decade 1980 to 1989, and that's the occasion for our reminiscing this afternoon on Fresh Air. Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air.
Hi, I remember a magazine in the early 80s had its final issue. It was December 1983, and I was wondering if our historian could tell us a little bit about the death of National Lampoon. I remember it was a very sad time for me. I used to get the magazine every month in the mail. And in November, they said, next month is our last issue due to, I forget what it was. And that was years ago now. And I was wondering if our historian could tell us some inside facts as to the death of National Lampoon magazine.
Well, I no one really quite remembers exactly what happened. After all, it was 7 years ago. I think it really had to do with the fact that everyone on the Lampoon staff stopped talking to each other about 1969 or 70, and throughout the next 13 years it became harder and harder to turn issues out.
Mm-hmm.
And by 83, the people who actually were writing weren't talking to the people who were editing the magazine, and it made it very hard to get the articles ready. So I think that was probably a prime factor in the death of Lampoon in any case.
I remember it was a very sad day. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks for calling. I hate to, be preachy, but I think that perhaps if some of you had enrolled in the International Fred movement, that a lot of your interpersonal conflicts would have been solved.
Now, wait a minute. Now, your name is Terry, right?
Right.
I don't think you're eligible to be in the Fred Movement.
Well, I'm not. I'm not really a supporter of it, but I've seen people who the Fred Movement has really benefited. They've become Fred again.
Most of them were named Fred. Yes, you can be Fred again. And there is a letter in the current issue of Fred Magazine about just that, whether someone named Frederick or Frederica is a Fred. And of course they're Freds. And the Fred Movement has tended to accept people like that. Or if you change your name legally to Fred, you can join. Personally, I think the Lloyd Bridges Movement, or the Bridgesians, as we choose to call ourselves, has a slightly better plan for the future. Then, of course, there's the whole cult that's gathered around Louise Joy Brown, the first test tube baby back in the 70s, who declared herself the Ms. Saya, as you may recall, when she reached puberty. And she has quite a following, too.
Okay, well... You know, I don't participate in a lot of these things myself, but teach his own.
Yeah, but you keep bringing up the Fred Movement, Terry. I just want to point that out.
I think that there's a certain charismatic quality within the movement, and that's why I keep bringing it up. We're going to go back to the phones now. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, I'd like Mr. Cerf to recollect the event whereby a portion of the atmosphere was drawn away. And the Earth was destroyed by cosmic rays.
Well, I think you've got that wrong. Otherwise, we wouldn't be here talking to you now, would we? Unless you know something I don't, which is possible.
Oh, well, this is our astral embodiment that is talking.
Oh, well, that's, you know, you got me there. I mean, I wouldn't want to deny that without more facts.
Well, I say, since your name is Surf, I'll say hang 10 and hang up.
All right, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for coming on. See, we get all kinds of people participating here in Fresh Air.
Well, you know, out-of-body trips, speaking of astral projection, were very big. They were actually in Los Angeles, astral body trip travel agency set up. And you could get a babysitter to sit with your body, or body sitter, excuse me, to sit with your body while you were out of it.
Were there fees that were charged for
that? Oh, sure. Big industry.
Were there, like, flight attendants?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about employee harassment.
Yes?
What do you think about it?
I think it's wrong.
Well, I work at a tire store. I'm serious.
I'm serious, too. I'm totally against employee harassment.
I've been beat up about it dozens of times.
Well, that's...
I'm very serious, I swear. It's not a laughing matter. And,
Did you want to talk about the 1980s?
I did.
You did talk about the 1980s?
No, I want to.
Well, go ahead.
Okay, well, do you think that there'll be employee harassment in the 1980s?
No. Yes, I think there will, unfortunately. Though the United Multinationals, who are guiding our destiny now, I think will do their best to keep that to a minimum.
Okay. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to talk to Chris about the great automobiles of the 1980s, particularly the Nader Motor Company cars.
The Nader Motor Company, yes. Well, you know that Nader himself has become somewhat of a recluse, partly because he's... really, I think, afraid, you know, that the pollution in the air might kill him if he goes outside, and he's strapped into his bed with safety belts. That sort of thing. He hasn't been seen for several years. But certainly the cars did go through a tremendous change during the 80s. Of course, during the first half of the decade when there was no oil or gas, such cars as, rickshaws became very big. Partly because joggers were unemployed due to the depressed economy. It was a great idea for them to pull taxis, the Chinese checker, the rickshaw became known as. And I don't know if you know the Run Service rickshaw company, but they had cabs throughout Philadelphia, New York, a lot of the major cities.
Yeah, I seem to recall that now.
Yeah, and in the late 80s, of course, when the oil glut struck right after Halley's Comet appeared, and as we were talking about earlier in late 85, President Carter, who was again president then, came on the air with a lot of appliances blazing away behind him and suggested we use up as much oil and gas as we possibly can to get the economy back in shape. And therefore, very, very large cars became the order of the day in the second half of the decade. The Volkswagen Continental, for example, I'm sure you remember.
Yes.
Yeah, a beautiful car. It looked very much like the Beetle, except it had five or six windows in it. Then there was the upwardly mobile home, which was a three-story house on wheels, which got 35 gallons to the mile.
Yeah, I like the Victorian model of those particularly.
Oh, yeah.
With all the little steeples and all of
that. Oh, well, that's a beauty, isn't it?
Yeah, sure is.
That's a beauty.
Okay, thanks.
Well,
thanks
enjoy
for
your traveling.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Oh, hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yeah, I have a question. I can't remember what happened. Do you know in the 50s and 60s, it started making electronic parts smaller and smaller? And they made them so small that they vanished. What happened after that?
What happened after electronic parts vanished?
Yeah.
Well, they actually kept miniaturizing them still further. But, you know, there was a computer in China during the 80s that was quite interesting, since it didn't use any electronic parts at all. They're a little slow on their electronic technology over there, but they do have tremendous advantages in population resources. So they built the first human computer.
I mean, a lot of toes and fingers and so on all end to end?
No, that's not what they did at all. But there were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people inside a large stadium, each of whom was a bit of information. Each of them had to remember whether he was on or off. That's all he had to do. The really skilled workers could sometimes be on, sometimes be off, and they were what were known as the RAM, or random access memory.
Right.
The ROM memory, or the permanent memory, were actually people who were just yes or no all the time, and they went to their grave only being one of those. And it's a very slow computer, but they hold out a lot of promise for it.
Yeah, well, that's a good peon's life, isn't it?
Well, it beats being unemployed.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for calling. Was there a generation gap in the 1980s, or was there a youth rebellion in the
1980s? Well, there was a lost generation in a sense, which was kids, because there really just weren't any. Well, there were a few, of course, and they were very powerful. But in the 70s, actually, the me generation, very few people were having kids at all. And then, of course, in 1983, which was the year of the UN-sponsored International Year of the Simultaneous Orgasm, there was tremendous performance pressure, which reduced the number of kids who were being born after that even further. And so there really wasn't so much a generation gap as everyone becoming much and much older. Of course, most of the diseases that were so widespread back in the 70s were cured during the 80s also. The result was that the population was much older in the 80s than it was in the 70s. And there was something called the age quake, in fact. And even the few people who were young did their best to look old by applying wrinkles and things of various kinds of makeup.
You mentioned the International Year of the Simultaneous Orgasm. There was a museum, I believe, that was an outgrowth of that.
Yes, in Los Angeles, the Museum of the Orgasm, I believe it was called. And also one of the great publications of the decade was a book, I think it was called I'm Coming, You're Coming. I'm not sure I should be mentioning that on the air, but it had it was by Thomas Harris and was one of the big successes of the 80s.
Okay, well, listen, we're at 387-6660. If you'd like to give us a call, my guest is Christopher Cerf. If you're just joining us, you may know him as a former writer for the National Lampoon. He's also one of the writers of Not the New York Times. And his new effort, along with Peter Elbling and Tony Hendra, is called The 80s, A Look Back at the Tumultuous Decade. And consequently, we're reminiscing about the 1980s. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, I would like to relate an incident that grew out of that the bill that the author mentioned, that no household was allowed to own more than 1,000 feet of twine.
That's right.
Okay, well, that was back in 1982 when that was passed. Well,
83, actually.
83, okay, I'm sorry. But
that's okay.
Shortly thereafter, I know they were enforcing this law very, very severely, and one of my neighbors... there was a little misunderstanding between the two of them. One of them called the police and told them that they had 1,005 feet of twine. And in the middle of the night, the police came and kicked down my door. And of course they measured it, and we only had say 900 some feet. Other people, they were the real culprits, and of course we were taken out of bed and everything put through this and.
God, what a shocking story.
Well, Frank Rizzo came out of retirement to vocalize on this issue here. He was in favor of the law. He thought it was a very sensible law.
Yes, well, that would figure.
Do you feel that they were making any progress? I have here is a House bill, and I want to just, if I could, say I want people to write to Congressman C-440A, House Bill C-440A, to repeal this bill, because I really don't think there's too much sense to it.
It's called the Regulated Objects Act of 1983, by the way, if you refer to that in your letters, perhaps they'll get a little more action.
Yes. Well,
Listen, you know, I have to thank you for calling, but we can't use the earwaves here to politic as blatantly
even
as I think
even against the Regulated Objects Act? Because that... And that and to proselytize for Lloyd
What's
Bridges
the
are the reasons I came here, Terry.
Wait,
I just want to get that straight now.
You go into it.
Well, Frank Rizzo is off for it.
Was he really the mayor in the 1980s?
In the 70s.
No, but he came
out of
retirement.
Mayor in the 70s.
Came out of retirement.
Remember the 70s?
Oh, I don't know. This is awfully confusing for someone of my age. Listen, thanks a lot for calling. Now, the next time you call, just control the politicking. You know, there are regulations we have to live
by.
Thank you. Okay, thank you for calling. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yeah, Terry, I want to say I think Freddie Silverman's done a great job at NPR in the 1980s.
Oh. Yes, well, it was sad what happened to NBC, wasn't it?
What kinds of programs did you think were the most indicative of his sensibility as applied to NPR?
Well, what he's done to the Options series is just incredible.
What were the shows on there that he was...
Christopher could elaborate.
Well, I can certainly tell you a little bit about Freddie's demise at NBC, and in fact, the demise of NBC itself. A show called Hippie Days, I think, is really what finished him off. That was the first show, as you may remember, Terry, and all of you listening in, that was canceled during its first episode on the air. It was canceled after its first commercial break, or during its first commercial break. Freddie had built that on his nostalgia for the 60s from the early 80s, and he just miscalculated entirely. In fact, the show received an 0.3 rating, which means no measurable audience. And that was just the last of a long series of things that happened to NBC. And when Freddie went out to light the big Christmas tree at Rockefeller Center in December 83, the lights wouldn't go on, and the Con Edison representative came up to him and told him the bill hadn't been paid, the jig was up. And that was it. Then Freddie went to National Public Radio, as you were referring, and has had quite a career there ever since.
Christopher, what about the movement to make Phil Donahue president between the hours of 9 and 10 a.m.?
Well, he actually didn't get as much support as we originally thought he would. In 88, of course, when the American Broadcasting System refused to cover the 88 presidential elections because of voter apathy. You'll remember that they even had to give away toasters at the polls to try to get people to go. In fact, in 86, they had to give toasters to people so they would run for office. But in 88, they decided they would have their own election at ABS instead of covering the national elections, and they elected the first popularly elected anchorman that year. And Phil Donahue was an early candidate, though he never really was taken too seriously. The race boiled down to John Kennedy, who, and you'll remember that Ed McMahon would come on and say, "Here's Johnny," when John did the Tonight Show. But and it was between Cronkite and Kennedy, actually, and Cronkite won quite easily.
See, I get really confused by this. I always confuse the fact that Cronkite was elected to the position of anchorman with the fact that the president, I thought, in the 1980s, was elected to do national call-in shows, and that, you know, rather than spending all the time making political decisions,
that they
hosted. Was it on National Public? I don't think it was on NPR, actually, but they did a phone-in radio shows.
Yes,
they became host. That was the position.
Yes. Well, that was an elected office also. There were many minor elected officials in addition to Chief Anchorman of the United States.
Listen, thanks a lot for calling. Is there any other favorite programs you'd like to tell us about from the from NPR, from the Freddie Silverman days there?
Well,
guess not. Okay,
speechless.
Okay, we
got
it. Thanks a lot for calling. Hi, this is Fresh Air. You're on the air.
Yes, I'd like to know if the gentleman there has any information on the 1986 revolution and coup in Transylvania, where Transylvania became an independent nation and pulled away from Romania and got closer alliances with Hungary?
Yes, I do have some information on that. That was part of the born-again communist movement that we mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And as you recall, Marx predicted in Das Kapital that the state would wither away once perfect Marxism had been achieved.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the Soviet Union, as it was known in the 70s, broke up into little states again, too, because the Soviet army disappeared one day. Parts of the Kremlin would not be there when people woke up the next morning. The withering away really began in earnest about 1986.
1986. Do you know if there was any relationship with the 30th anniversary, 1986 being the 30th anniversary of the Hungarian Revolution and all that?
It was 88, wasn't it?
Well, there was 50, 56 Hungarian Revolution, where they tried to revolt against Russia, and there had always been that unrest during the 70s in Transylvania against the Romanians because of all the Hungarians living under Romanian domination. So I was always under the impression that in 86 it was time to the 30th anniversary of the 56 Hungarian Revolution and the 1856 Hungarian Revolution. Hungarians revolt on a fairly regular basis.
Yes, well, there's a numerological kind of consistency to all of that, which I think was probably based on Russian Orthodox theory, that which became part of the born-again communist movement.
Uh-huh. Thanks a lot for calling.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. I was a little confused there again.
I don't know why. I mean, it seemed perfectly obvious to me.
When our caller was talking about Transylvania, I thought he meant the International Coalition of Vampires that had its international headquarters in Transylvania, the people who were responsible for all the drink blood commercials on television.
Oh, yes. Well, sure. And I don't know how you feel about those ads. I don't really like them much.
Well, I think that and deodorant should not be advertised on television. But everybody has their own sense of...
What do you think about neurosurgery being advertised on TV, as it has been?
Well, I haven't seen TV lately. What were those ads like?
Well, Neurosurgery City has been at bargain basement rates, recommending neurosurgery as a therapy treatment. And, of course, lawyers have been advertising for years, too, since that was legalized back in the late 70s. Torts R Us, the chain of legal franchises, opened in Chicago in 80 and has become, of course, one of the main advertisers.
Uh-huh. Well, why don't we take one more phone call, Christopher? I think that's all we're going to have time for.
All right.
Hi, this is Fresh Air, and you're on the air. You're our last phone caller for today, so I have to ask you to make it short.
Okay. I would just like to lament with both of you over the passing of the shopping mall. Now that Big American Cars are back in action, it seems a shame that we just have nowhere to go anymore.
That's true. It is a shame, but I think there's hope that in the 90s that we'll see the shopping mall again. And since the cars are bigger, the shopping malls will be bigger, too. So never fear.
That's true. And also, don't you think it's just a shame that polyester fabrics are no longer available?
Well, they are again. After the oil glut, they came back in spades, actually. In fact, there was a period where, there was a whole movement to ban polyester fabrics and all petro things back in the early 80s, and they wanted you to kill ocelots instead, who were more common than oil and oil derivatives. But that, of course, changed it with the oil glut, too.
Oh, I guess I've just been living in Colorado too long.
Pardon me? You were in Colorado too long?
Yes.
Well... No comment.
Thank you.
Thanks for
calling. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Well, Chris, what do you see ahead for the 1990s?
Well, as I said, I'm optimistic, or at least more optimistic. Of course, after the 80s, anything would probably be an improvement. But I really am impressed by the resiliency of the American spirit, really. And I also hope that if anyone is still able to read, that our book might help them. Santayana said that those who have not learned the lessons of history are condemned to repeat them. And we hope that if the 80s come around again, people will be prepared for them because they've read our book.
Well, if you're just joining us, my guest has been Christopher Cerf, who's worked with the National Lampoon and one of the people responsible for Not the New York Times. His latest effort is The 80s, A Look Back, and subtitled The Tumultuous Decade, 1980 to 1989. And Chris, before you leave us, I think we'd all like to hear you sing. So,
oh dear,
that's right. One of Chris's other affiliations is with Sesame Street. He worked with Sesame Street for about 7 years, and now continues to do some consulting with
them. And Joan Gans Cooney, by the way, was a consultant on our book. So,
right, and she'll, by the way, be with us on Fresh Air Monday at 3:00. Why don't we just listen for a minute to Chris and who? What's the name of the group, Chris?
Chris and the Alphabeats. It's a Muppet group for 4-year-olds. And any resemblance to the Isley Brothers is purely coincidental.
Okay.
Let's rock and roll it to Chris and the Alphabeats doing Count It Higher.
You told me you could count. You said there's nothing to it. Well, if you're so good at counting, let me hear you do it.
1, 2.
Could stop at 3. You got to count it higher.
Count it higher.
Baby, if you want to count with me, come on, let me hear you count again.
1, 2, 3.
see. You got to count it higher.
Count it higher.
Baby, if you want to count with me. Now let's just try it one last time.
One, two, three, four,
five,
six,
seven. Are you ready?
One, two,
three,
four,
five,
six,
seven,
eight.
Chris, I understand that in the 1980s, the nostalgia stations featured your record quite a lot.
Oh, they certainly did. I mean, it was an even bigger hit in the 80s than it had been in the 70s. And you know what a big hit it was in the 70s.
That's right. Well, what we were listening to is Count It Higher, which features Chris and the Alpha Beats. It's a Sesame Street record. Christopher Sarf, what a pleasure to have you here. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, I had a ball.
What's ahead in your future, by the way?
Well, I said we're working on our 90s book already.
Great.
But okay. Some other silly projects are coming along, and I'll keep working with Sesame Street, too.
Terrific.
I'm working on using computers to teach, actually,
uh-huh.
Which is a really interesting thing.
Okay.
And a couple of silly publications coming along, too.
Okay. Well, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you.